Amen. Our text this morning is here in Exodus chapter 4, and we are considering the second half of this chapter, verses 18 to 31, continuing where we had left off before the break for Resurrection Sunday. And so we're looking at Exodus 4, 18 to 31. This is an exciting time of year for a lot of people, and next year we're hopefully going to enter into the excitement a little bit as we recognize a number of young people who are graduating. If I've got my numbers right, there are seven of them from our church who are finishing up different academic efforts, and this is a time of rejoicing and celebration and congratulation. And it is an exciting time, but especially for those that are wrapping up their formal education, graduating from college, and now moving out into the workforce. It can also be a scary time. First, they have to find a job. Then they have to learn the job and get familiar with so many things, their coworkers, their work environment, and the specific tasks that they'll be required to do. And I'm sure that over the first few weeks, they'll be going through a lot of training, and they will also probably make a lot of mistakes as they get used to everything. And as I thought about that, I thought about when I first started teaching in the fall of 2001. I was excited and scared at the same time and put a lot of work, particularly into the first day of material, and nervously trying to get ready for that day and got everything together, walked out of my office to use the restroom and then go get my stuff and go to the classroom, and I came back and I'd locked the door behind me. And I was scrambling to get to class on time. I had to find my office mate to let me back in the office and was huffing and puffing to get there and do my job for the first day. Then there was a time, I think that same semester, when I put together one of my first tests, and I hate writing tests just slightly less than I hate grading papers. Don't tell anybody because that's all I'm doing this time of year. But here I was and put all this energy into writing this test and had this huge matching section. I forget what it was all about. And I laid out all of these options, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, however many they were. And I distribute the test, and one of the students approaches me and says, the bubble sheet only goes up through option E. How are we supposed to answer these other questions? That was embarrassing. It doesn't really end. Actually, within the last week, I have locked myself out of my office twice. You know that it's the end of the semester and my mind is elsewhere when that starts to happen again. But that's the sort of thing that you sort of expect when you are first starting a job, learning something new. And that idea of your first few weeks on the job, when you have finally made a commitment and you're trying to get familiar and develop some kind of routine, some kind of skill, some kind of expectation, that really is the nature of our passage this morning. We have spent several weeks walking through this conversation that God had with Moses, where he was calling him to a new and overwhelming task, the job of taking the people of Israel out of Egypt. And it was a helpful conversation. It was very informative. It was very reassuring. And at a certain point, it became rather tense, because the more the conversation went on, the more opposed Moses was to this calling, and the more excuses he kept putting up. And by the end of it, as we considered the first half of chapter 4 last time, Moses had run out of excuses. He really had no choice but to follow God's call to go down there and to be God's instrument to deliver the people of Israel from slavery. I kind of think that even at this point, he is struggling. And he is going, but it's almost like inside he's going kicking and screaming. and still not too comfortable about this idea and still struggling with how this is all going to work out. But he does take his first steps in that direction. And as we come to our passage this morning, we are reading about his first days on the job and a period in which he still needs a lot of encouragement and he needs a lot of orientation. In fact, we're going to find that he also needs some pretty severe correction in a surprising way. And this morning, we want to consider those developments under the title Foundational Lessons for Following God's Call. This is very much of a transitional passage between the call and the beginning of the work and a few things that take place in between transitioning to the Exodus itself and how the Lord continues to prepare and to guide Moses toward his call. Foundational lessons for following God's call. And though there has been a great deal of emphasis on Moses making the right decision, yielding himself to God, surrendering at last to this call, a lot of emphasis on Moses getting straightened out and getting busy about this job, really, the first and main lesson is not about Moses. It is not ultimately about him. And this task before him is not ultimately up to him to make the mission succeed, as was the case with so much of the other material here. The focus is on God and viewing this scenario and this calling through the filter of God and his character and his work and his commitments. And so the first of these foundational lessons in verses 18 to 23 is the assurance of divine sovereignty. We have already seen a great emphasis on God's all-encompassing rule over these circumstances. But the Lord just keeps hammering these things home again and again from different angles. The assurance of divine sovereignty, that is the most foundational lesson that this man needs at this time. And in verses 18 to 23, God's sovereignty is laid out in a number of different ways. The first of them is very ordinary, and it relates to what he calls, or what we call, God's providence. It is things that do not necessarily appear to be God's work on the surface, things that are not obviously supernatural or miraculous, God's quiet, God's behind the scenes, God's silent work to make things happen that need to happen in order for his will to be done, God's sovereignty in the ordinary or his providence. Read with me, first of all, verse 18. Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now you could argue that at this stage of life, I mean, Moses was 80 years old. He didn't really need his father-in-law's permission in order to go about God's calling. But it did represent a major change in what this whole family had been used to, and there was a great deal that was going to affect Moses' extended family. And so he does the right thing, and he approaches it in a very gracious way, and yet we still have questions about the way that it's worded here. Why does he say, "Let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive"? He knows they're alive. God has told them that they're there, and God is ready to use him to get them out of there. Why did he leave it so general? And doesn't say anything about the burning bush or about the real reason that he's going to Egypt. Maybe he doesn't want Jethro to know the danger that Moses and his family were going to be exposed to. Maybe this statement is indicating that Moses is still waffling and he's not entirely on board with God's plan. Maybe he's going forward but still half-hearted about it. At any rate, Moses' father-in-law gives the blessing. And we're not going to spend a lot of time here, but we do want to note something of the providence of God, not just in that God made this man willing to be supportive, and in fact, he continues to play a role in all of this later on in the book, but does this sound familiar to you, this scenario of an individual who had fled from one place to another and ends up at a well, finding a woman and a family through which he ends up getting married and has his own family, and at a certain point, because of the call of God to return where he came from, he has to part with his father-in-law. There are many parallels like that between the life of Moses and the life of his ancestor Jacob, who was also involved in shepherding. And this conversation, short as it is, I believe is designed to get you to remember the providence of God and all those other events. It's a kind of an echo, and yet it's a lot better resolution, because the last time things did not work out so well with Laban. Initially, Jacob tried to run away without clearing this or even letting him know, and there was a bit of tension as Laban catches up with him, and they finally part on somewhat decent terms. One commentator said this: for both men, the experience involved a parting with a father-in-law who had enabled them to build their own families in the security of his. This parting from family in some way recalled God's summons to Abraham to leave his father's house and country. For Jacob, however, the parting was acrimonious and filled with moments of mutual deceit, overcome in the end by mutual agreement, whereas for Moses, the parting was with the immediate blessing of the older man who still had a part to play in the story. And this is something brief. There's not a lot of detail, but I don't want us to disconnect it with all of the other evidences of the providence of God, especially in the patterns that have been repeated throughout the lives of Abraham and his descendants. It was very much of a fluid experience, moving from one place to the other, saying goodbye, family tensions that came about sometimes as a result of that, and here the Lord eliminates any problems along those lines, unlike what happened with Laban. The Lord is just taking him one step forward toward his calling. And then we read in verse 19 that the Lord said, or you could translate it, had said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all of the men who were seeking your life are dead. Now, apparently, one of the reasons that had kept Moses from wanting to go back there was the fact that he knew he was guilty of a crime that could have easily and, humanly speaking, should have cost him his life. And you would have feared the same, that going back was going to mean you would suffer vengeance for having killed an Egyptian 40 years earlier. These things are not soon forgotten. And here the Lord assures him, Moses, I have eliminated that obstacle as well. Enough time has gone by that these individuals are dead. You don't have to worry about that potential threat. So that whether in terms of his father-in-law's blessing or his safety in Egypt, Yahweh has providentially cleared the way for a successful trip. We want to see the hand of God in these events. And speaking of patterns that are repeated throughout Scripture, does the comment about Moses' enemies being dead and that it's okay and safe to go back, does that sound familiar? Let me read to you, looking forward, from Matthew chapter 2. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought that child's life are dead. Again, as we come to the New Testament, we find an echo of the sort of thing we're reading about here and how God continues to deal with threats against his redemptive program. These kinds of repeating patterns, they ought to assure us that God is orchestrating history to accomplish his plan and to enable us to play whatever our part is in those plans. God has taken away those obstacles for this man. And so we see his sovereignty in the ordinary. But we also see his sovereignty in the unusual, which is now laid out as we read on the next couple of verses. This isn't what we call providence. This is what we call miracles, the almost opposite of providence, where it is huge and obvious that this is a supernatural work of God and that that is the only explanation for it. We read in verse 20, "So Moses took his wife and his sons and had them ride on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the staff of God in his hand." We've been introduced to that staff before. There was nothing unusual about it up until the conversation at the burning bush. And now it becomes the immediate instrument through which God is going to work his miracles to deliver his people. And verse 21 goes on to say that the Lord told Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the miracles that I have put in your power." This is a reminder of those three signs that the Lord had already performed for Moses to assure him, and that he promised to perform in Egypt as well. And as we read on in Exodus, it's not going to be three. It's going to be one wave after another of divine interventions through miracles. And so that's another way that the Lord is assuring this man, this foundational lesson to encourage him to keep stepping forward, is his power through miracles. Now, when we come to apply that to our lives, we have a bit of a challenge because we are not necessarily expecting that God is going to work those kinds of ways, those miracles, in our own daily efforts to carry out our calling. But what I want to point out is that really was the same position that the average Israelite lived in for all of their lives. This stands out because it is so unusual. The average Israelite was more living along the lines of God's work and sovereignty through providence. And yet even for them, the record of certain unique moments in history are brought up again and again, not to promise them that God's going to do exactly this supernatural thing for you, but to assure you that whenever that is necessary in the plan of God, God is able. It is a visible evidence of his supremacy and his trustworthiness, that when that is what is required in those unique moments, God steps in and intervenes in mighty ways. And we find the same thing in the New Testament, and especially with the climactic miracle that we celebrated last week, the resurrection of Jesus. It's not as though you and I are seeing physical resurrections every day. But there are stories of some of them in the Bible, and chiefly of Jesus himself, that we are brought back to again and again and again as the historical confirmation of what is the measure of what God is able to do and what is the measure of what he will yet do for us in the end. God's sovereignty reflected in historical miracles. Now, all of that is very encouraging. God's providence in your own life, his occasional miracles, confirming his sovereignty. But there is also a dark note here as to another way that God is going to show his sovereignty. And it has to do with Pharaoh. And the Lord tells Moses up front that even with all of this encouragement, when he first gets to Pharaoh, and for a prolonged time, Pharaoh is not going to be inclined to let them go. There should have been no surprises for Moses. The Lord is very straightforward ahead of time as to what the response is going to be. In fact, the Lord makes a striking, a shocking statement about really what is behind Pharaoh's rejection. Look with me at what it says in the rest of verse 21. Here is the next way God speaks about his sovereignty. Yes, you're going to go back. Yes, you're going to work those miracles, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Now, that had been touched on a little bit in chapter 3, verse 19, where the Lord had said, I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. And now he says it more strongly, more specifically, actually, Moses, I am going to harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Now, what sense does that make? If God wanted to get a job done, and he was trying to assure Moses that this was going to succeed, you might have expected he would say, and here's another proof of my sovereignty. I'm going to work so mightily in Pharaoh's heart that I'm going to make him really soft, and he's going to be milquetoast, and he's going to say, sure, go ahead. Been waiting for this moment all my life to get rid of you people. Look how sovereign I am, Moses. But he actually says, no, I'm actually going to make his heart hard so that he won't let you go, and I'm going to make this a lot harder than it would have to be. Why would the Lord do that? What's going on here? Well, that's actually a theme that's going to come up multiple times as we continue to work our way through the story of the Exodus. In fact, there are some 20 different statements in these chapters concerning the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. And this is not something you can avoid if you want to understand the work of God and even how he assures us for our own calling in that work. Let's consider a little bit what is happening here. First of all, it's about his heart, about Pharaoh's heart. And that heart has often been referred to as a person's control center. It is the real you deep down inside, and it has various functions that drive you and that shape your life. It includes your thought processes. It includes your emotions and your likes and dislikes. It includes your inclinations. It includes your capacity for decisions. So if Pharaoh is going to let Israel go, it's going to have to come out of his heart, that decision, that willingness for them to leave. And yet we read in various ways that there was a hardness about his heart. Actually, in those 20 statements, there are three different Hebrew verbs that have to do with hardening. It's not some minor note. It's not some sort of obscure and minimized thing. It's brought to the focus so much that God says, let me use different words to describe it. One of those words has to do with being heavy, and it speaks of a heart that is dull or insensitive. One of them has to do with being hard in the sense of being really strong, and we would say stubborn, maybe. In fact, that's the word that's used here. And the third one means hard in the sense of something really difficult, like somebody's being very difficult. You might say rebellious or insolent. They're hard to work with. So the Lord is being pretty creative and diverse. He doesn't want you to miss this. He uses those three different words. And furthermore, there are three forms, grammatically, that those verbs take. And this may seem a little technical, but it's hugely significant for us. Sometimes the hardness is described as a state of being. And you could say his heart was hard, or his heart became hard, and it doesn't really tell you who actually did the hardening. It's just describing that that is the condition. There are other times we're going to run across where Pharaoh is the one who is said to be the subject of the hardening. He is the one who actually makes a decision to become hard. And yet there are other times, like the one that we find here, where God is the one who is clearly causing the hardening. God says, I will harden his heart. And it's especially that statement that we struggle with as to how this works and God's role in this whole process. How can God harden somebody to where they continue in disobedience and sin, and yet God himself not be the one directly responsible for sin? We know from, for example, the book of James, that God himself not only does not sin, but he does not tempt anyone to sin. He cannot be the one directly responsible for something evil. How then can he be the one doing the hardening in a case like this? And furthermore, how can it be that if he is the one hardening, he can still look at a human being and hold him accountable for that individual's choices and punish him and rebuke him for having made a bad decision? How is it that God is the one hardening and yet he's holding people accountable for their choices? How does this work? Or you could also ask, what does God actually do to harden someone? Leading to those other kinds of theological struggles we have. What does God do to harden somebody? And I was very thankful to run across this statement by Dr. Mike Barrett. He says, quote, the simple answer is nothing. What does God do to harden people? Nothing. The narrative gives no hint that Pharaoh was forced to do anything against his will. There is no evidence that in his heart he wanted to liberate the people, but God would not let him. In other words, Pharaoh is not going to stand before God one day and say, God, I really love these people. I really, in the depths of my heart, long for them to be free from slavery and to enjoy the promised land and have you as their God, but you wouldn't let me. You hardened me. You kept me from that. You turned my will in a direction against what I wanted. There's no indication that he wanted to let the people go, and God wouldn't let him. In hardening his heart, God simply let Pharaoh be Pharaoh. So that the way he ended up hardened and God was involved in the hardening was by the Lord just saying, this is what you want, and I'm just going to let you keep going down this path. I'm not going to stop you. I'm going to put more pressure on you. And it's just going to bring out the inclination of the heart that is already there. And folks, isn't this the same pattern that we see when the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1 is talking about human depravity? He talks about how God has made himself known to humanity at large. And even though there's all of this evidence to God's power as creator, they don't want him. They're not thankful. They don't honor him. And so what does God do? We read this whole sequence in verse 24. It says, therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity. And as the cycle rolls a little further and they continue to get more hard and reject the Lord, verse 26 says, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And then as it continues to unravel, verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And this is how hardening works, and theologians refer to it specifically as judicial hardening. In other words, it's not arbitrary where God is just going around at random picking people and he wants to harden them. He is essentially just letting them continue in the path that they have chosen for themselves. And he is judging them by letting their depravity get more and more hard and extreme. This seems to be the explanation for what's happening here. And you say, but why did God do it that way? Why didn't he stop Pharaoh? Why didn't he soften his heart? You can think of some possible answers to that question. Maybe if Pharaoh had so willingly and so happily let them go, he would have taken the credit for this all working out. Maybe it was simply, I tend to think this, that God actually saw that he would get more glory by having a greater opposition and challenge to overcome. He upped the ante so that the job would be even harder, so that he had more opportunity to demonstrate his power, and so that in the end he would get more glory. Whatever God's reason was in the counsels of his will, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart was not an accident. It was not something unanticipated. It was not something at this point that Moses should have been afraid of. But the way it is phrased here, it is something that should have moved him to even greater trust in the sovereignty of God. God brings this up specifically in order to show, I am running this whole drama. I could stop it at any point. I could easily just wipe Pharaoh out. I could make him softer. The fact that he's harder doesn't mean that somehow I'm really struggling to win this battle. No, I'm actually involved to make it even harder for myself. Moses, learn that lesson. God's sovereignty in judgment in the case of Pharaoh. But there's something even more reassuring as we come to verses 22 and 23. God's sovereignty as well in grace. We've seen God's sovereignty in the ordinary, in the miraculous, in judgment, and now in grace. As he continues to give him direction for his calling, verse 22, then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. Now there's another harsh statement there at the end, and yet this is a precious passage for the people of God. Because this is the first time in Scripture that God's people are referred to as God's son. In fact, the Lord doesn't say just my son, he says my firstborn son. And that is so gracious because there was nothing special and nothing inherently unique or godly about Abraham or the Israelites that made them deserve the status of being God's firstborn son. Just like Pharaoh couldn't take the credit for the Exodus, God's people couldn't take the credit for it either. You think about your children. The fact that it was those children and not some other children, the fact that that one ended up being the firstborn instead of somebody else in the sequence, you had nothing to do with that. They had nothing to do with that. That was just total sovereign choice as to who would be the children, who would be first, second, third, whatever. This is all of God, and this is all of grace. And they can't take the credit for the Exodus any more than Pharaoh could. God is demonstrating the sovereignty of his grace. And the level of commitment that he shows to Israel in that grace is even more amazing when the Lord said what he's going to do if Pharaoh refuses to let his firstborn son go. There will be poetic justice. It's going to come back on your own firstborn. And that will finally be the thing that breaks his heart, at least temporarily. To let the people go, his own firstborn son would be killed. Paul makes this comment in Romans 9, For the scripture says to Pharaoh, "For this very purpose I have raised you up, that I might show my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." And then he makes this comment, "So then he has mercy on whomever he wills, and he hardens whomever he wills." On the side of hardening, it is a matter of the Lord just letting them go. On the side of mercy, Paul says nobody seeks God. That was not your choice to change your heart so that you would want God and want fellowship with him, want reconciliation with him. That is an indication God has sovereignly intervened in your heart for his own glory, and in mercy he has shown you himself and drawn you to faith. And that's the focus at this point in talking about Israel as God's son. There was nothing special about them, and there is nothing special about us that God should choose to save us from before the foundation of the world. And it's the graciousness and the wonder and the security of that status that more than anything gives us the assurance that we can and must obey the call of God. Look at the favor that God in mercy has given to me that he didn't have to. You and I can remain committed to the Lord and his plan for us precisely because he is and always has been and always will be eternally committed to us. The sovereignty of his mercy and grace is the foundation for our own following of his call. Now, after all of that focus on the Lord and his sovereignty and his work, it is now time to give a little bit of attention to the role of Moses and his decision following up on that. And what we find in the next few verses is not only confusing, but it is extremely unflattering and makes Moses look even worse than he already did. It's also one of the hardest passages to interpret in the book of Exodus, and yet it makes a vital point in this context. And as it turns out, it has to do with Moses' own firstborn son, the very thing we had been talking about. And so we come to verses 24 and 26, and this additional lesson. We've looked at the assurance of divine sovereignty, but secondly, the importance of covenant faithfulness. That's the second foundational truth as he is here on the first few days of his job. You got to get this, Moses. You must cultivate covenant faithfulness. Look at verse 24. "At a lodging place on the way, Yahweh met him and sought to put him to death." You thought that Pharaoh's firstborn was going to get put to death, and now God is trying to kill Moses. What in the world's going on? "Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, 'Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me.' So he let him alone. It was then that she said, 'A bridegroom of blood,' because of the circumcision." What a jarring note in the narrative. After saying he would kill Pharaoh's son, Yahweh is about ready to put one of his own people to death, and the very man that's supposed to get the Israelites out of Egypt. How do we understand this? Well, there are some who say that God was actually about to kill Moses' son, Gershom, who is the one that got circumcised on this occasion. And there's a passage in Genesis 17 when the Lord first talks about the circumcision of Abraham's descendants, where he says, Genesis 17, 14, "Any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant." So some say the Abraham, according to that verse, and the Lord was working to kill him. And yet Gershom doesn't even come up by name in this passage. And it's not until verse 25 that you realize what is going on with him, it is more natural to see Moses as the one referenced in verse 24 as the father, because he is the one that has been in focus throughout this passage, and also because Zipporah talks to him about the impact of this regarding him being a bridegroom of blood. There's nothing that I see that indicates the character has switched, and so we seem to be reading still about Moses. Why would God want to kill him when he was the instrument of deliverance? The problem was that he had not had his son Gershom circumcised. We don't really know how old Gershom was at this point or what was the background to this. But for this child not to be circumcised was a very serious offense in the eyes of God in light of the Abrahamic covenant. And it suggests that for all those years in Midian, 40 of them, Moses had been in what we might call a backslidden state, that is, not visibly connected with his heritage, not confessing the covenant that God had made with the descendants of Abraham, staying apart from that line of divine election and blessing, and just off on his own, doing his own thing, unwilling to associate with his people during that particular period. And that was such a problem in the eyes of God. The circumcision that had to happen was such an issue that it threatened to undo the entire plan of deliverance. We don't know what God did to Moses here. Maybe struck him with some kind of a heart attack or breathing issue or stroke or something, but he was incapacitated and apparently unable to resolve this problem, and so his wife steps in to fix the problem. Now that is fascinating. I pointed out when we were talking about Moses at the beginning of this series that as a vulnerable baby, he owed his life to some women who were willing to stick their necks out. And whether it was his own mother or sister or the daughter of Pharaoh, the women were the heroines of the story that delivered Moses. And now it happens again. And it further highlights this man's weakness and his spiritual slowness. Zipporah carries out an emergency surgery and circumcises her son on the spot. And then she says, "You're a bridegroom of blood to me." What does that mean? Well, nobody really knows. Maybe she was just disgusted by the whole thing and mad at him. I can imagine that. Maybe she was actually relieved that her husband's life would be spared and that their marriage could continue, even if it was at the cost of this bloody ritual. Or some have suggested that that expression, bridegroom of blood, was actually a phrase that was used in ritual language when circumcisions were done as a way of kind of formalizing the whole thing. There is a lot about this story that we do not understand and that I don't feel the need to dogmatize about. But I want to focus on what is clear, and that is God really, really, really cared about circumcision. Something so seemingly insignificant, like why would that rate so high that it called for this? It was because although an external symbol, it symbolized something at the core of God's relationship with his people. It was the visible sign of his covenant relationship with Israel, and not to undergo the ritual, God viewed it as you were disdaining the covenant. And this cannot be tolerated, especially by the one who's supposed to be leading the people of Israel. How could Yahweh's deliverer remain in such a state of fundamental disobedience that had to be corrected? And even though Zipporah was not herself an Israelite, she understood something of the magnitude of this issue and had the courage to do what had to be done. And this was one of the lessons that this man had to learn early on: faithfulness to the covenant, even to the symbols externally of the covenant. Now, here again, we struggle to apply this because you and I are not under the Mosaic covenant or under the sort of conditions or signs of the Abrahamic covenant with circumcision and that sort of thing. And yet, let us not miss a powerful lesson that this passage teaches to us as well. We are being warned here through Moses' example about the danger of hypocrisy and the danger of inconsistency, particularly for those who are in a position of service to the Lord. And we are being instructed that God cares deeply even about external matters of ritual and worship if they are things that he has clearly appointed. And we live in a day when people tend to minimize externals. And when there is such an emphasis on the heart that the outside doesn't matter, even to the point of minimizing basic things about the worship of God, or the closest parallel, though not exact, but the closest parallel to circumcision would be baptism, which is a symbol, a ritual of initiation into the Christian faith. We live in a day where those kinds of things are so negotiable and so minimized. This is not the attitude the Lord has about things that he himself has appointed as far as his worship and his people are concerned. And that would be one application, but I don't think it's the only one. We are being taught here that no amount of Christian service can mask or make up for disobedience to any clear command of God. And God, particularly when he's working to prepare a servant for a task, will often put his finger on that thing very painfully until it is addressed. Because he is looking for, by his grace, a consistency between his work and his worker. We understand our weakness and our sinfulness, but there are some times when the issue is so severe and so contradictory to the message that you're preaching that God says, we got to stop this whole thing until this thing is fixed. It is that important. The importance of covenant faithfulness and obedience. Now, thankfully, as the passage concludes, the attention moves away from Moses and his failure and back on to the Lord and his faithfulness. And the final lesson is this, the encouragement of fulfilled prophecy. The encouragement of fulfilled prophecy. Lesson number one was the assurance of divine sovereignty. Number two, the importance of covenant faithfulness. Number three, the encouragement of fulfilled prophecy. And what we read in the rest of this, just a few verses left, are fulfilled prophecies. Look at verse 27. The Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him to speak and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. That's not a new development. The arrival of Aaron, his willingness to participate, and the fact that he is willing to serve as a spokesman is a direct fulfillment of Exodus 4, verses 14 to 16. The Lord, as he had promised, prompted Aaron to go out there and told him where to go to meet up with him and gave him the willingness to serve as Moses' companion and as a spokesman so the job could be done. So there is that fulfilled prophecy about a helper. But there is also a fulfilled prophecy about the response of the people of Israel to Moses, which is another thing that he struggled with. What if they don't believe me? What if they ask me a question I can't answer? What if they don't respond and don't want to follow me? The Lord gave him certain assurances, and now read verse 29. Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. And what I read there was a fulfillment of Exodus 4, verses 2 to 9, exactly what the Lord said was going to be their response. They responded. The Lord used Moses and Aaron's words The Lord used the signs to move these people to believe. Now, we understand that's not the end of the story. In fact, there's going to be another hard lesson that he is going to be confronted with in chapter 5 when the plan seems to fall apart when he first tries. We understand that Israel is going to continue to struggle with unbelief. And yet, we're off to a start here. And it is not just kind of another thing that happened. The start that is here, as far as their belief is concerned, was a fulfillment of a promise that God had made earlier in chapter 4. And it was designed, like these other things, to encourage Moses that the Lord could and would do everything else that he had promised to him. The assurance of fulfilled prophecy. You know, on both ends of this passage, the emphasis is all on God. You've got his all-encompassing sovereignty over all these realms at the beginning, and at the end you have his own unrelenting faithfulness to his covenant promises. And as you look at what's in the middle of that, if there was any problem that could possibly, quote-unquote, slow down God's plan, it wasn't the problem with God. He did not lack resources. He did not lack wisdom. He did not lack power. The problem was Moses' own disobedience. And yet, the Lord, through the very harsh thing he had to do, overcomes even that problem, and the stage is set for the full manifestation of his glory in the deliverance of his people. I want to take us back as we close to verse 31. And these words I find to be touching. When they heard that Yahweh had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. And I trust that whether today or through the rest of this series, that will be the effect of these things on us as well. That as we see so many reflections of the working of God to fulfill his promises, that we would find ourselves worshiping with these people. May we learn the lessons that Moses learned on the first few days on the job. And may we bow in worship as we come to know more and more about our covenant God. I invite you to bow your head this morning as we consider the relevance of this passage for our lives. We are going to sing a prayer of reliance on the Lord and his guidance in just a moment. But it may be the Lord has directed your thoughts to some truth about him that you need to confess and be renewed in your faith. Or it may be that there is some area of disobedience, like with Moses, that has to be addressed before God's plan in your life and through your life will move forward. That may be the thing that he is addressing. So let's take a moment and pray and seek him about the application to ourselves.